From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we are at NHPR in Concord, New Hampshire, where the polls have been open. I saw lines at 6 a.m. East Coast time, of course, this morning. So let's go right to Paul Steinhauser on this primary day. He's a Fox News campaign reporter. And Paul, we have news. Joe Biden leaving New Hampshire?
Yes, heading south. The original plan was for Joe Biden to headline a victory or, a New Hampshire primary party this evening in Nashua, New Hampshire. He is now going to be flying after a little later in the afternoon. He'll be heading to South Carolina, where he will be doing a campaign kickoff in Columbia. This is a change of plans, and it's probably a sign that Joe Biden will not be finishing third in this primary, and, you know, the results may be a little more lackluster for him.
There are some tea leaves, obviously. His campaign put out a press release. So talk about the factors here. Yes, maybe there's – he said in the debate that – it was a gut punch in Iowa, and he felt he might be getting another one here. But also, we have new polls out last night showing Michael Bloomberg, who hasn't been in this state at all, or Iowa, cutting into Joe Biden's following among African Americans. Biden's been holding to the theory that that's where he's going to get the vote. You know, what else he's seeing?
Yeah. No, this is you're right. These are tea leaves. This is very, very telling. Joe Biden limped into New Hampshire from Iowa, where he had a disappointing fourth place finish. And now it looks like he could have a fourth or a fifth place finish here, which is just amazing, considering this used to be the unheralded or unrivaled front runner in the race for the White House. He's heading to South Carolina. Why? It's his firewall. This is where he's going to make his last stand, it looks like. And hopefully he'll get a bounce there and move on to the Super Tuesday states. He's trying to get to the states with electorates that are much more diverse than Iowa or here in New Hampshire, which is overwhelmingly white. He never wrote off New Hampshire, but it sure looks like he is doing it now.
Yeah. Well, you were also at an Elizabeth Warren campaign event. What did you see there?
Yeah. Oh, Warren was at the University of New Hampshire. A lot of younger voters there. She was thanking supporters. And we reporters asked her about where she needs to finish tonight in the primary results. She wouldn't take the bait, but she did say and stressed that this is a 30-state campaign. She's campaigning in 30 other states right now, and that she's continuing on regardless of the results here. She also took a little bit of an indirect shot at some of her rivals, talking about how they are sucking up to billionaires. Remember, Warren is fueling her campaign with grassroots donations. She's been very critical of Pete Buttigieg for taking those big dollar donors.
Well, donations. So has Bernie Sanders, who's kind of sharing the number one spot with Buttigieg. He's also been mentioning that. But you've been out. We've been out. It doesn't feel as if – it feels as if Pete Buttigieg is not being harmed by those volleys. In fact, he seems to be expanding.
Yeah, he had some big shows of support over the weekend, large, large crowds. So did Bernie Sanders, of course. His final rally at the University of New Hampshire had over 7,000 people. That's amazing. But no, Buttigieg, according to the polling that was done ahead of this primary, he will most likely finish in second place. If he doesn't, if he finishes lower, that's a problem for him.
What else are you feeling out there today? I mean, we know that turnout is always key. Amy Klobuchar had a big debate night. She seems to be gaining some steam. What are you seeing?
And Klobuchar this morning, talking to reporters, was crowing about her her strong surge in these last couple days, and also that she won the vote in two of those three tiny little towns, those little hamlets in northern New Hampshire that voted midnight.
Well, let's talk about those for a second, because we don't get way too excited or overly excited about these little tiny towns that vote at midnight, because we listen to Stranglehold, the great podcast here on NHPR, which is, you know, these are kind of, you know, publicity events. Mm-hmm. However, Klobuchar, Bloomberg, just a handful of votes, but fascinating.
Yeah. The biggest of these towns is Dixville Notch, the most famous. They've been doing this since 1960. Bloomberg is not on the ballot in New Hampshire, but he got four write-in votes, and he carried the day because only six people voted there, one for Buttigieg, one for Bernie Sanders, and then those four write-ins for Bloomberg. Listen, we're getting closer to Super Tuesday. Mike Bloomberg is becoming more and more of a reality and more of a player in this Democratic presidential primary.
Of course, and we asked the state's governor and others, you know, asked Governor Sununu, what does that mean if somebody can be a viable player and skip your primary? It can't be good for the state. Of course, he dismissed that, but as anyone would. But just tell us in the minute we have left, what else are you seeing out there? I'm seeing a lot of Tulsi Gabbard supporters and signs, Andrew Yang. I mean, What are you seeing?
Yeah, no, both of them have devoted supporters. Even though they're not high up in the polls, they really have their – these are niche campaigns, and their supporters are very fervent about them. But for Gabbard, for Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado, candidates like that who have been nonstop here and not campaigning anywhere else, you got to wonder if they have lackluster finishes, do they carry on? I think we'll see some people drop out after the New Hampshire primary.
Andrew Yang's been asked about his financing. Does he have the money? There are already questions being raised about that. Paul Steinhauser, Fox News campaign reporter, again with the news that Joe Biden has left New Hampshire, is on his way to leaving.
We'll be leaving a little later.
New Hampshire. Seems like a concession to some people. We'll follow that. Paul, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, today the World Health Organization announced a new name for the coronavirus, COVID-19. In China, the virus has already killed more than 1,000 people and infected more than 43,000. Many offices and factories there have been closed for the time being as a precaution, and the tech industry is starting to feel the impact. Let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So how many of our tech products are being affected by coronavirus?
So the unscientific answer is a whole heck of a lot, I think. And it really runs the gamut from big name products that you know, like iPhones, to much smaller products and startup companies that make things that you don't necessarily think about, or companies that are making small pieces of tech products that we don't really think about, but still go into the larger products that we buy. Mm-hmm. So this is our reminder that China is a huge piece of the globalized economy, right? And especially when it comes to tech. On the list, Nintendo Switch consoles could be a little bit harder to get. Oculus virtual reality headsets also slowed down by factory closures. Tesla says deliveries of its Model 3 may also be delayed. A lot of companies were hoping to get back to business this week, but since the WHO has declared a global health emergency, it's hard to say. For instance, iPhones, considering the huge numbers of iPhones being made and the kind of fuzzy math that you start to get when looking at production numbers on the other side of the world, it's tough for us to figure out exactly how many fewer iPhones will be born thanks to the virus, but some estimates say Apple could ship as many as 5 million fewer phones in this quarter.
And a lot of these factories, I wonder how many workers are even able to go in, because many workers in China are being told to stay home, work from home. Obviously, in a factory, you can't do that.
You can't do that. Foxconn, the company that manufactures tons of Apple hardware and hardware from other big tech companies as well, has closed some of its biggest factories because of coronavirus for weeks. This week, again, is supposed to be the week that a lot of workers in China are going to get back to work, but the outbreak of the virus itself doesn't show any signs of slowing down at the moment, and it's unclear when the government is going to allow a lot of these larger companies to start getting back to full capacity. But even as the production lines get moving again, they'll be operating with a reduced staff because of these travel restrictions inside the country, too. So we don't know.
So basic supply and demand here, if they can't make as many, let's say, iPhones,
yeah,
then there won't be as many, and the demand probably will stay about the same as it is. Does that mean that these things are going to get more expensive for consumers in the U.S.?
Right. It's unclear. I think right now it's a little early to tell whether some of that cost will be passed on to the consumer, although that definitely seems like a possibility. Depending on what you're buying and where you're buying it from, also, you might see this impact, you might not. So, for example, Apple AirPods were already behind schedule, so we're seeing those production lines further impacted. Mm-hmm. So it might be even harder than it already is for some folks to get AirPods. You also have to remember a lot of startups here in the U.S. go to Shenzhen in China to get their products made. So you also might see some apologetic emails in your inbox if you contributed to like a Kickstarter campaign, for instance. Some of the smaller stuff might be impacted too. And companies are also reporting that Chinese factories are having trouble getting their raw materials. Mm-hmm. So there's an impact there as well.
And what about the Chinese consumers who are not able to go to stores because many of the stores in China have been closed because of the coronavirus? Is that going to start to hit U.S. companies as well, or tech companies in general, because they're not selling to one of the biggest markets in the world?
Right. So some current estimates say that China is essentially buying 30% of the world's semiconductor chips and a quarter of the world's phones. So yes, we might see an impact among companies outside of China that are trying to sell to Chinese consumers, you know, along with factories of big tech companies. Retail stores in China have been closed, as have corporate offices. So Apple, Tesla, Microsoft, Samsung, and Google have all been on that list of closing actual retail operations in China. And we'll have to wait and see, obviously, but we can assume that it's going to be harder to sell your goods in China or to hit sort of estimates that you're hoping to hit.
One more thing, Ben. A lot of people in all kinds of industries have cut back on travel because of the coronavirus, big conferences, et cetera. Is that impacting the tech world?
Absolutely. So I think that there are going to be some businesses that might potentially go under because they weren't able to make deals that they wanted to make around this time of year. As far as larger companies, so for instance, there's a huge tech event in Spain in a couple of weeks here on the 24th, Mobile World Congress. A ton of companies from all over the world participate in this. Thousands of people go. It's this annual gathering where companies unveil new products. And already big companies like Sony, LG have dropped out of the event. And also event organizers are saying that they will ban travelers from around Wuhan who are trying to attend. So absolutely, there's an impact over the next few months at the very least.
That's Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
We're in New Hampshire for today's presidential primary. At the primary 4 years ago, we reported here on one of the biggest stories of the decade. No, it wasn't how badly Bernie Sanders beat Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump's win. It was the opioid epidemic. New Hampshire, then second only to West Virginia in overdose deaths. Life expectancy was down for the first time in 75 years. And this was the first time many in the national media saw this all up close. So where are we now? Well, the number of deaths is down, but that's attributed to advances in saving people from overdoses. New Hampshire launched a safe fire station program. Instead of people handing over newborns, they handed in themselves. There's also a 211 emergency line to get help at so-called doorway hospitals. Those on the front line say there's still much more that needs to be done. But there's also a story that offers a glimmer of hope for pregnant moms battling addiction. To tell that story, we head to Rochester, New Hampshire.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. I'm Carrie Norton.
Nice to meet
it's nice
you.
To meet you.
This is so cozy.
Thank you. Yeah, if that's a good Oops. Word for it. Yeah, we make every bit of space work.
Carrie is a nurse. She co-founded Hope on Haven Hill in this rambling 1850s Greek Revival country house for moms with substance abuse issues trying to stay sober.
This is our kitchen.
Big and beautiful and
yeah.
sunny. It just looks like a wonderful old country kitchen with a big table for everyone to sit around.
Yep.
We see babies. Baby
sightings. I'll show you into the living room. So this is our living room. The other area is our baby changing room and another little space for babies to play.
This is Christopher.
There's toys, but also social workers, therapists. This is a medical treatment facility. The women have to be sober. Some of them are on methadone. All help each other stay sober by attending support groups, cooking meals together, learning bonding skills. Some are about to give birth. Some already have. How old is this little guy?
He just turned 18 months.
That's adorable. And we have, it looks like a newborn over here.
Yep, we have a little newborn over here.
Upstairs, the bedrooms. This old house was once part of the Underground Railroad. Today, it shelters 8 women at a time, and they can bring other children under 5 as they welcome a new one.
So every room has cribs, bassinets, changing tables, rocking chairs, everything a mom would need. I'm imagining for some of these women, they've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, we're taking care of women who are homeless and imminently homeless, and a lot of them are generationally. So I've had more than 2 or 3 women have said that they haven't even had beds in their lives. We have women coming from actual, it's not couch surfing, it's actually they're homeless on, you know, in a tent or not outside.
Amazing. The women are encouraged to be honest if they're struggling, if they relapse, told to ask for help.
We give women support with so much dignity that even when things are hard and not going well, they know that they can reach out immediately, and so many do.
And you know, someone listening might say, you know what, when somebody's an addict and using heroin, this isn't just about the young women, it's about children. What do you say to those people who just really don't trust this terrible addiction and
worry about the effort put into a mother reuniting with a child or having a child?
Sure. So for me, it's a chronic healthcare condition that should be treated just like any other healthcare condition that a woman might have throughout her entire lifespan, and we should treat it.
It is heartwarming and hopeful, just like the story of how this all started. I want to talk about the beginnings. I understand you came across a young woman who was 8 months pregnant, and you were calling around. You couldn't find the resources. Did you send out a late-night email asking, does anyone know Oprah or Ellen DeGeneres?
Yeah, it was a Facebook plea. Her name was Abby, and I had just brought her to the one place in New Hampshire that after, we call it Five Acts of Congress, an entire team of people for 2 weeks worked to get her into this place. I brought her there, and on my way home, my mind just blew. And so I put up on Facebook, does anyone know Ellen, Oprah, or somebody rich? Because we need to do this in our community. We need to do it now. And when I woke up, I had a lot of people responding, including my co-founder.
Colleen, who said, well, I have a house.
Yeah, she doesn't know Oprah, Ellen, and she wasn't rich herself, but she had a house that was just the perfect fit for what we needed to do.
And we are sitting in that house, and this is where that story gets heartbreaking. Abby, the young pregnant woman who inspired this project, had her baby, became sober. But experts know the most vulnerable time for a mom battling addictions is right after giving birth. There's little housing that's safe, no treatment, no work. Abby became an activist, lobbying lawmakers. Her sister had died of an overdose. But soon, Abby did as well. The women behind Hope on Haven Hill mobilized. They opened a second center, called it Abby's Place. Women from Haven Hill transitioned there to stay sober, find jobs, be part of a community. Carrie wells up over the memory of Abby.
She has a legacy. You know, I always have to remember, like, not to stop, because she didn't stop when she rallied and was doing great, and when she had slips and wasn't doing well. She put herself out there. She put herself out there to any, you know, legislator, any person that would listen to talk, to say, this is the problem. This is what's going on. This is how I'm having a really hard time. You know, women deserve to have this health care treatment and then support. And if for some reason they have a recurrence, they deserve the chance to have this chronic illness immediately treated again as needed. And they deserve to be moms. They deserve to have their children. They love their babies. And they are great moms. The flip side is, I know she's cheering us on, because what we get to do every day is watch women thrive.
One of them, 32-year-old Lauren Phillips, who sits with her talkative, pink-cheeked, 18-month-old toddler Rory. She and Rory started at Hope on Haven Hill. Now they live at Abby's Place. Lauren has a job. She's been sober for 6 months. But it's a rough road. She clings to Rory now, but he's been in foster care. She shares her story to help other young moms.
I went into my first inpatient treatment center when I was 19 years old. From that time, about 15 years ago, until November 2017, I was just in and out of treatment centers. I did 3 years in prison, and that's when I got out in November, and I got pregnant with this little guy pretty much right away.
So, but take us back. How did you start? What happened?
My drug of choice is heroin and cocaine. I grew up in like a upper middle class family. My mother passed away when I was young, but my dad was, like, to say he is an amazing man doesn't do it justice.
How old were you when you started using heroin?
I started using heroin when I was 16.
How'd you get it?
An ex-boyfriend. At the time, it was like OxyContin and stuff like that. By the time that I was educated on it, it was too late, you know.
So how did you get to jail?
I ended up stealing from my family, stealing from my father's business. I sold drugs and had 2 sales charges. Once I got into using, that was just number one.
You got pregnant, well, it would have to be about 18.
Right when I got out of prison. So I was sober at that time because I had just gotten out of prison, and I paroled to a sober house for women in Nashua. So I was able to stay sober shortly after he was born. I relapsed. You know, I proved to myself the hard way at that point that, like, my love for him is, it's not as strong as addiction. And, like, I needed that. This disease is stronger than anything. A call was made to DCYF, and they showed up at my house. I had to get into a program of some sorts, and if it was a program that would allow me to take him, then I could take him with me.
I ended up, by the grace of God, at Hope on Haven Hill. I got so much out of this program, you know, and in being a mother to him, I realized what I was lacking before. I guess now I can say that I wasn't willing to change everything about my life, and out of fear, you know. I had been with his father for a long time. I didn't want to give that up, and it led me to a relapse. And at that point, I felt hopeless at that time, but the women that worked here, they believed in me at that point. And he ended up going into foster care in July.
How hard was that?
Yeah. I needed to get myself better before I could be there for him. I ended up going to a 28-day program, and, you know, I knew that I wanted him to be happy and just have a good life, and I loved him so much, but I think at that point I still didn't think that I was going to be in that equation. God had other plans for me, thank God, and I stayed in touch with Carrie, and they were planning on opening Abby's place, and it has just been amazing, and I share my story with anybody who will listen, because I know today that it's possible.
You haven't taken your eyes off him one second. What happens when you look at him?
You're going to make me cry now. I mean, he's just perfect. I get this feeling looking at him and knowing how perfect he is, but I also know that my disease is stronger than that. Like, I have to rely on God. I have to rely on the women in the program that have walked this journey before me and that then show me this is how we did it.
We spoke with new mom and recovering opioid addict Lauren Phillips, whose 18-month-old Rory climbed all over her while we talked, at Hope on Haven Hill, a residence and medical treatment center for pregnant moms trying to stay sober in Rochester, New Hampshire. We also spoke with the center's co-founder and director, Carrie Norton. Lauren, now sober, and Rory now live at Abby's place, where she gets on her feet.
Two major teachers' unions have called on schools to rethink lockdown drills. The American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association say they do not recommend active shooter training for students. 95% of American public schools conduct some form of lockdown drill. For more, we're joined by Lily Eskelson-Garcia, president of the NEA. Welcome.
It's so nice to be here, and thank you for doing this important story.
Well, schools often expect these drills to make students safer. You say they can do more harm than good. Why?
They absolutely can. You know, we want to keep our kids safe. That is why we're out there talking about keeping very dangerous weapons out of the hands of very dangerous people. But folks are desperate to do something, and what happens when you're not sure what that something is you just make stuff up. And what they've said is, hey, we do fire drills. Let's do active shooter drills. What could go wrong? If you talk to the National Association of School Psychologists, they will tell you these drills can cause trauma. They can trigger a psychological reaction that scares kids for a long, long time. You're saying someone is in our school and they're shooting up the school and they may come in and shoot you. And so run and hide. It really is something we have to rethink. Is it causing more trauma and stress in these kids than actually keeping them safe?
But then how do you prepare kids and teachers for an eventual shooting if one should happen? And as you know, they happen with regularity in this country.
Well, they actually don't happen with regularity in this country. So first, let's get the statistics right. About 150 tragedies of people have died in public schools since Columbine. That's for the last 20 years, 150 tragedies. The chances of winning the lottery are better than an active shooter in your school. So schools are still very safe places. But let's go back to your question. There are things that you can do. You do not have to traumatize kids. The adults in the school can be trained in how to have a lockdown. And that's what we believe should be happening right
Just
now.
Just train the adults.
Train the adults. You also, if you're going to have any kind of drill, and that includes with the adults, by the way, you announce it in advance. The school psychologists, the folks that are the mental health providers, actually have some good advice for us. So you announce the drills in advance. You do not scare people. And we want prevention, and that means that you start today. And that means that you are identifying if there are students who may need special help. Some of the tragedies, starting with Columbine, were the students in that school mm-hmm. themselves. What are we doing to make sure that our kids know if they have stress, if they have mental health issues, that there's someone on site there to take care of them? And I can't say this enough. We need to do something to keep very dangerous weapons from being easily accessible to potentially dangerous people.
That is Lily Eskelson Garcia, who is president of the National Education Association, which, along with the American Federation of Teachers, has said today that they do not recommend active shooter training for students. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Some of the greatest artists in music have played behind NPR Music's Tiny Desk. Could you be next? Enter the Tiny Desk contest by submitting a video of you playing an original song behind a desk. If you win, you'll get to play a Tiny Desk concert. Learn more at npr.org/Tiny Desk Contest.
It's here and now from New Hampshire, where Democrats have the headlines today. But last night, President Trump had 12,000 supporters at the Southern New Hampshire University Arena in Manchester. They started lining up the day before.
Don't be a Democrat. Buy yourself a Trump hat.
Trump up, guys.
$10 hat, $10 a bargain.
Get your Trump gear here, folks.
I like him because he speaks his mind. He doesn't hold anything back. And that's what I think we need in the world today. Everything offends everybody, and we don't need that anymore.
Actually, I've been a long-time Democrat, and the more I listen to him, the more he was saying, you know, some of the things that I had concerns with. Immigration is a big thing for me because where I'm from, Dillon, South Carolina, you got the immigrants coming in, and they taking all the jobs that we were working. And it took Donald Trump to wake people up to that.
You know, I think he's done a great job despite incredible odds with the Congress not working with him. If he can just tone it down a little bit and try to bring people together, he can accomplish, and the Congress, if they wanted to, could accomplish great things.
Everything he does is good. It works out good. I mean, he might have done some things wrong, but nothing impeachable. You know, and he's still looking out for our country.
Inside, the president held a rollicking rally, but said something that wasn't true that perked up our ears because of our next guest.
Now, I can't tell you what's happening tomorrow because, you know, you have some pretty strange election laws here, right? Remember last time we won the primary tremendously? We should have won the election, but they had buses being shipped up from Massachusetts, hundreds and hundreds of buses. And it was very, very close, even though they did. But this year, you know, we have a great governor, Governor Sununu, great governor, Chris. And now you get prosecuted if you do what they did. So it should be a lot different.
Well, and Governor Chris Sununu joins us in the NHPR studios. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on the show.
Well, and I should tell people that you were just kind of laughing while you were listening to that. You have called out
any president says you're great, how can you not smile a little bit?
Well, I'm thinking about the words before that,
yeah.
Which, as you know, are completely false. Your own Secretary of State, many others have, you know, concluded there were no buses of illegal voters coming from Massachusetts during the New Hampshire election. Now, you've called out President Trump before when he called New Hampshire a drug-infested den. I want to give you the opportunity right now to correct President Trump on that.
Sure. Well, those are two separate issues. The drug-infested den, yeah.
As soon as he made
that comment, I called him right away.
So he just said that busloads of illegal voters came from Massachusetts.
So what he's referring to there is we were the only state in the country where you didn't need to be a resident. So you could come, same day voter registration, which we have here, and well, we always will, and say, well, I'm going to be domiciled here and vote. We didn't have to be a resident. So
but
we
nobody
had this
did that.
Oh, no, no. That's, people claim to be just domiciled
buses
temporarily.
And buses?
No, no, the buses is separate. Yeah, that's a separate issue. So what we really – what again, it's referring to is we didn't have a residency law. The only state in the country – we have a residency law now. That's all.
But no, your Secretary of State said – there were no people abusing this.
Oh, no, no, that's right. So that's the whole thing. None of this was illegal. We had this very odd law, the only one of its kind in the country that stood.
Will you be picking up the phone again and calling President Trump and saying, please don't say that thing that isn't
Look,
true?
Look, President Trump says what President Trump's going to say, and he's got his own style and all that. So, but again, we just focus on the 603 and making sure you want to vote here. Like every other state, you got to be a resident here now, and that's it.
Is it okay that the president just says what he's going to say, even if it's not true?
Look, I don't like the way the president says certain things. I don't like the tweeting. And I think a lot of his supporters would say, oh, if you just stay off the Twitter and all that kind of stuff. We have very different styles. But we do things very differently here. Now, I very much approve of a lot of the policies, the tax cuts, the regulatory reform, the USMCA agreement created a lot of economic opportunity for the citizens of New Hampshire. We have the most booming economy in the Northeast right now, and that's not by accident because the policies get results. And as governor, that's all I care about, getting results.
Do you worry that some of your Republican voters here in New Hampshire can't ignore the president's language? We have met Republicans across the state of New Hampshire very much supporting President Trump, but we have bumped into people who say, you know what, I can't take the coarseness anymore. I can't take the lies. Let's listen to this. Is Toni. She runs the Canterbury Country Store. And we were stunned. She was one of President Trump's biggest supporters.
A lot of it has harsh, punitive, vindictive, not good. He became very, very crude.
Are you worried about that?
In terms of the election? Or in terms of
she is not voting for President Trump.
Yeah. President Trump's going to win New Hampshire. When folks go to fill out their ballot in a ballot box, they look at what's going to impact themselves and their neighbors and their communities. And economic prosperity brings a better quality of life, better access to health care, more opportunity for opioids and mental health and all these things that really impact our day-to-day lives. And people are going to vote in those interests, especially if on the other side, the answer is a socialist like Bernie Sanders. This is the live free or die state.
And no question, the Democrats' critics say that they have to be much better at defining democratic socialism, which has nothing to do with changing the markets, but it's about bringing things like more government-provided health care to people. And as you know, you've got a scourge in this state. I know you know that. And a report out from Dartmouth College early on in the opioid epidemic said that the state was just lagging behind, wasn't doing enough. We know that there's been a push to change that. But then we also know that yesterday the president released a $4.8 trillion budget proposal that includes cuts of student loan assistance, affordable housing, food stamps, and Medicaid, the same Medicaid that many addicts here in New Hampshire need.
Yeah, the previous administration did so little on this drug and opioid crisis, essentially ignored it. We've fundamentally changed that. And when I went down and met with the president in 2017, I said, look, this is what we need. We need funding. This is how we're going to use it. We're going to rebuild our system. And they provided that funding, over $50 million. So they deserve a lot of credit there. And that's why he talks about it a lot. The other issues you're talking about in terms of the budget, the number one thing we need out of this budget is flexibility. And I think I speak for 50 governors when I say that. States want flexibility to design their own systems. It cannot be a Washington one-size-fits-all big system. Big government is not here to solve your problems. That is not the purpose of government. Government is here to open up doors of opportunity for you or your family or your business or whatever it might be. And that's my job, to set up as many doors as possible and then live free or die, right? You go through the doors that fit you and your path. So the flexibility is the most important. So we'll take a look at this budget. I haven't looked at it too in-depth in the past couple of days. We've been a little busy.
Well, you know how severe the cuts are.
And I also know that's not the final budget. Congress is going to get their hands on it. They're going to make some changes. The most important thing is something gets passed.
Okay. Yeah. I want to make sure I ask you about today's primary. We don't get all excited over the Dixville Notch vote at midnight and other towns that do that. I mean, it's fun and everything.
It's fun, yeah.
But word does get out. I mean, it gets amplified. What happened at 12 midnight? And what happened is that Michael Bloomberg got a lot of votes, not 3 out of 5 in Dixville Notch.
Yeah, give it with a lot.
But still, Michael Bloomberg is showing up also in polls. Does this worry you as a Republican, that
no.
some people who might be frustrated with Donald Trump might navigate to Michael Bloomberg.
No, no, not at all. So Michael Bloomberg is very being very open about his attempts to buy an election, right? He's not even playing in New Hampshire. He's just trying to buy votes. He's not meeting voters one-on-one. He's not engaging on a debate stage. Now, he's going to get a lot of delegates out of that, to be sure. He won't get enough. He'll go to it'll go to some sort of very aggressive brokered convention. Nobody should play into that.
But so let's say Michael Bloomberg does do well.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe
and he will.
Do you worry about the New Hampshire primary? He didn't participate.
No, 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 not at all. Look, because he's not going to win. So he's going to be an example of when you ignore New Hampshire, it doesn't work. He couldn't win. You can't thumb your nose in New Hampshire in the primary and win it in the general. Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it sets a tone for him for the rest of the country. He's not earning it. He's not spending the time with the voter. He's spending time buying TV ads.
We've been speaking to business people really negatively affected by the tariffs. We spoke to a metals worker who can't get the steel that he needs. He's been devastated. He still supports Donald Trump. He thinks in the long run it'll even out. But he and his wife were in tears. Your lobster exporting business, not just in New Hampshire, but all of New England, has been decimated. We spoke to a facility that was sending tons of lobsters to China. But now because of the retaliatory tariff from China slapped on lobsters, all that business went to Canada.
Look, the USMCA agreement is a great example, right? The president negotiated a great deal. It's great for Mexico. It's great for Canada. It is fabulous for the United States. Phase one of a China deal is now in place. Phase two is coming down the line. These are things that weren't even attempted by previous presidents. So he's slowly evening the playing field. The tariffs hurt. They stink. I get it. But our economy is really, really strong here.
That's Chris Sununu, New Hampshire's two-term Republican governor, up for re-election in November.
Always.
Someone named Sununu will.
Well, every 2 years. I'm the only governor, one of the only governors in the country that has to get elected every 2 years.
Governor Sununu, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
President Trump's impeachment trial is over, but federal and state authorities, as well as congressional committees, are still pursuing more than two dozen investigations into Trump and his businesses. For more, we're joined by Washington Post reporter David Farenthold. Hi, David.
Hi.
Well, let's start with Congress. The impeachment inquiry started there, of course, but what other congressional investigations of the president are still active?
Well, there's a lot that are theoretically active. I think a number of committees, including the Judiciary Committee, are looking at sort of following up on pieces of the Ukraine inquiry, trying to get John Bolton to testify, learning more about what Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney knew. Obviously, a little bit of the urgency of that is gone because of the impeachment inquiry is over, but I think they want to follow up on that sort of stuff. I cover Trump's private business, so the things that I'm really watching are the financial investigations. So there's a couple different ones that are now kind of headed for a climax in the Supreme Court. A couple different committees, Ways and Means and Oversight, are trying to get copies of Trump's tax returns and other tax documents from his tax preparers and some financial records from Deutsche Bank, his lender. The hearing is going to be on March 31st before the Supreme Court about whether they can get those documents.
And what's the likelihood that the Supreme Court will say yes?
This is such a novel case. It's really hard to know. I think the Trump people have hurt themselves, though, and putting on my amateur legal scholar hat here, the arguments that they have made in these cases about why these committees can't have these documents are so broad, basically saying no one can investigate the president at all, either in Congress or in local law enforcement until he's out of office. I don't think that the Supreme Court is going to want to endorse that. As conservative as the Supreme Court is, I'm not sure that's going to work.
There's also a lot of precedent over the decades of presidents releasing their tax returns and not having any harm come to their presidency as a result of that.
That's right. And the precedent in the Supreme Court, there's a case involving Richard Nixon, another case involving Bill Clinton, where both presidents sort of sought to use the presidency as a stonewall to keep people from prying into what they'd done. And in both cases, the presidents lost unanimously at the Supreme Court. This divided Supreme Court, I don't know if we'll see a unanimous decision, but that's good precedent for those who are trying to get Trump's records.
The president's campaign and inaugural committee are also under investigation. What's going on there?
Well, the latest in the inaugural committee was the D.C. Attorney General. The District of Columbia has its own Attorney General who sued the Trump's inaugural committee because it is a D.C. registered nonprofit for basically wasting charitable funds by handing it over to Donald Trump. But one of the things that they found was that the Trump inaugural committee had paid $1 million to the Trump Hotel in D.C. to rent a ballroom that they didn't really even use that much during inauguration weekend. It seemed like the purpose of the inaugural committee became sort of to funnel money back to the Trump business. Now, that lawsuit just got filed. It's in its early stages. And even if it succeeds, it's not going to put anybody in jail. It just may shut down and the inaugural committee and regain some money.
You've also been looking into some of the president's conflicts of interest related to his businesses and possible violation of the emoluments clause, which we've been talking about for a couple of years now. What's going on there, and is that likely to go anywhere between now and Election Day?
Well, the short answer is it's not likely to go anywhere between now and Election Day. What we thought when Trump took office and kept ownership of his business and used that business to do business with foreign governments and with his own U.S. government, both those things seem to be pretty clearly outlawed in the Constitution. The Constitution says presidents can't take payments from foreign governments and can't take payments from the national government beyond their salary. But because no president had ever really even come close to that line, it was written in the Constitution, but there was no kind of case law. There was no precedent. There was no there was nothing for the courts to go on. Courts love precedent. And so by sort of shattering the norm, Trump gave himself this enormous head start where for the last couple of years or last 3 years, all the people who sued him over the emoluments clause have been bogged down in just the initial step. Well, who can sue the president over the emoluments clause? Whose job is it to enforce that? And you've seen all the different avenues that have been tried. There's plaintiffs from the D.C. and Maryland attorney generals. There's Democratic members of Congress. All of them have been rejected at one stage or the other, and they haven't even gotten sort of over the hump of getting discovery, sort of learning what business Trump has done with foreign governments.
David, the president and his allies have, as you know, gone after the Biden family and Hunter Biden for, they say, profiting off of his father's name by taking a job on the board of this Ukrainian gas company, Burisma. Is anyone looking into the president's children and whether they have been able to profit off of his presidency?
So the two sons, Don Jr. and Eric, who are out of the White House, still run the Trump Organization, which has always profited off the Trump name. Now that Trump is the president, they profit off the name of the president. So that means at Mar-a-Lago and at Bedminster and at the Trump Hotel in D.C., places where the president often goes, you know, the value of those places to potential customers is astronomically raised because if you get there and you get the president's ear, you can influence his decisions on a number of topics. So it's not like they've taken a job with a new company as far as we know, but their old company has been sort of retooled to profit where it can off the president's name. And there's one other aspect of this that I think we're just learning about. We published a story about it last week, which is the Trump Organization charges the taxpayers, us, to house Trump's own Secret Service agents. When Trump goes to his properties, Secret Service agents go with him. They have to. And the Trump Organization has chosen to charge those Secret Service agents above market rates, like $650 a night for a hotel room, $17,000 a month for a cottage in Bedminster, New Jersey. The taxpayers pay. So that's something where they're directly profiting off the taxpayer because Trump is president.
That is David Farenthold of The Washington Post. David, we'll be following all these threads along with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.